unless it's Meech Lake, the prospect of some kind of a little economic fluctuation, which I believe like a hole in the head, it's not going to happen. What's the deal? You know, what are we going to do tomorrow? You see, we're in a danger of trivialization here. So, well.
Okay, that was an excellent rant. I'd say we stay home. We get used to doing nothing. It requires discipline, which is what I thought you meant by the prison. The new discipline, we have to develop an eco-fascist mentality.
Well, I didn't follow that one actively. Like, I tried to describe in the progress of electrical consciousness in a dynamic, quick way.
Yeah.
That was analogous to what we would have called creativity.
Yeah.
But we have to bring creativity to the prison effect. Now, I only call it the prison effect. I don't call it a prison. But I wanted to emphasize that that slowing up that we're going to have to do is going to take time. It's going to take four-dimensional time. It's going to take a lot of momentum, a lot of weight, a lot of that kind of thing. You know, because it's so easy to think of just electricity, right? But in the physical equations, the just weight, just dropping a great heavy rock from a very far distance with a tremendous velocity, so it hits another rock and it stops cold. Now, you can't do that on this planet because you have to accelerate it. That's a bullet, okay?
Yeah.
But you can do it if a piece of rock comes wandering in from an interstellar space and hits the Earth. The only conditions that have to be met are that there's a resolution. It's either going to go through to the core or it's going to stop. And the Earth is quite massive, so you can have a pretty big rock falling on it. Its speed has to be something else, because it's going to, the faster it's going, the more friction it's going to burn up more in the atmosphere, you see? You need a lot of mass, a lot of speed. But there's no reason in principle why that rock couldn't have been traveling at 0.9 the speed of light.
Yeah.
But of course we don't ordinarily see anything traveling at that speed. We just see Halley's Comet wandering by at a few clicks, you know?
Are you talking about an immovable object meeting irresistible force?
No, I'm talking about the Tunguska effect in Siberia, where
yeah.
you said that had to be an atomic. But I'm using that as an example to point out that physics is just as much physics in terms of the dullest possible examples, such as dropping a very heavy piece of steel about, say, 30 feet onto a very solid, unyielding surface.
Yeah, cliché to archetype.
Well, whatever. But the same Brownian motion is going on down there.
Yeah.
Like you're not... I just don't think that we're going to get into a higher plane or an ethereal level, a level in which we're not constrained by slowness and heaviness and tangibility of the Earth, except by the exercise of our imaginations. We must use the imagination. We must become better storytellers, better mathematicians, better describers. It's scary, sort of, in a way, because you get so much action out there, governments want to control it. But the biggest thing I see that's happened is that we're very slowly trying to accept the fact that the world may now progress at a very faster rate for the next few years, and we may be able to do it safely if China, Russia, ourselves, if we can agree with each other and ourselves, if we can find a way to do it that works and that leaves the imagination free. We're going to have to... The most recent economic initiative is to... take the fruits of high tech and put it in the hands of the so-called third world people, and forget the intervening, forget the 200 years of slow growth that we had to start with the steam engine and get to the transistor, right? But we can't without the TV set, they see that world because that original telegraphic electrical impulse is operating. And they haven't all quite caught up to the fact that they've seen it yet. But if we move fast, they might. If we don't move fast, look at Iran and Iraq replicated the First World War. Look at the crudities that are going on in Sri Lanka, where Arthur C. Clarke used to live, and he was an original science fiction guy. I think he still does live there.
Yeah, he does.
And look at all these. Look at the big thing that happened 10, 12, 14 days ago. The Iraqis, they didn't put a payload into space. They put a rocket into, they put the vehicle into space. They asserted it, and there wasn't one ounce of follow-up. It was in every newspaper, plain and simple. The Iraqis said they put something, they put the end effect rocket into orbit. Now, it didn't have a payload on it. There's no little satellite floating around there, but the shell of the rocket is now part of the debris in low orbit, right?
Yeah.
The Syrians, yesterday, made peace with the Egyptians. It's getting very fast and very tight, and we can't tolerate failure. Anwar Sadat, for example, was the Mahatma Gandhi of his own time. The Syrians have learned a social discipline. The Iraqis have accepted a weird identity. The Iranians are the only poets. The Iraqis are just quite busy letting us call them names, which is what we've been doing for a long time, and they've been grabbing their atomics. Now, they can bomb the reactor until they make peace, okay? But you know what the statement is. The statement is that the world of Islam respects itself, will be together, and will be in orbit. Now, the Japanese on the business pages are starting to give voice to long-suppressed sentiments of anger at the American discussion of their reality and perception of them. There's been two very good items in the last 3 or 4 days. A book that's circulating in New York, which uses some pretty strong language. It's supposedly for Sony executives, speaking of business management in contemptuous terms. And there was something else in today's Globe which modified that, softened it a little bit. It claimed to be an interpretation of the SRI Shinbun or some damn thing news service. But what I'm really trying to say is the Japanese could have put complex payloads in orbit, space labs, Landsats, the whole thing, at least 12 years ago. In their maturity, they didn't do it. The Chinese, and I'm sure that part of their maturity is recognizing the simple fact that when they and the Chinese go up together, they will be precluding the terrible development in future reality of what has previously been an antagonism and could be a very big, bad, severe war. So, but we never thought the Iraqis would do that. We thought, geez, those guys just out in the sand there in the desert, the Arabs. Now, I say the Iranians are the only poets out there now. The Old Testament used to be, it still is, some of the greatest poetry of the human race. But the other poetry is also out there. The old Persian manuscripts, the old epics, Gilgamesh, all that stuff. The Indians, the Hindus, they'll eventually get around to it. There's a lot more of it out there, too. But just take it one step at a time. But we have to see, Gorbachev saw a lot more than that. Now, who did he talk to when he came over here? He talked to Eugene Whelan, the farmer. Turns out that he's not like Andropov. He's not a secret policeman. His background is, regional development and agricultural and regional economic management sort of thing. But it's his courage staggers me. I hate to be like this and just to be almost a lambent kind of a pink, but I honestly believe, and this is a funny thing. Remember they used to say the Russians had a great soul and all that kind of stuff? You know, the Russian people have a great soul. It's been out of fashion for 30 or 40 years to say that, but that was the word. I mean, when the French had their revolution, the Russian army, they had a bloody big war in Europe, they got all the way to France, and they just loved the French. They said, yes, beautiful liberty, equality, fraternity. They went back to the Tsar, and they said to the Tsar, look, man, check this out, you know. These are beautiful ideas. The whole thing about that. Now, I'm looking at it again here, and it seems to me Gorbachev might just be saying something as, it could just be as simple as, we really want to be friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's, so anyway, the thing is, we can't afford not to be, because the, we're all going to have to be up there. Now the Americans and the Russians are going to be in orbit, but putting a base on the moon, converting the surface and materials of the moon, cracking them down into basic chemical elements, using a technology like electrolysis, which splits water into hydrogen and oxygen. This can be done with rock. I was just reading yesterday, and I'm sure you've read this. If you're up on Tunguska, you're up on that. But you can do it. You just, all you have to do is put a CANDU reactor on the surface of the moon, and your problem is with the electrodes, but you can make the rock boil, and you can fool around. And as a matter of fact, if you like, you can take machinery up there and do it the hard way. It doesn't really matter how we do it. It's just dead easy to park on the surface of the moon, build a whole bunch of complexes underground, and start doing all kinds of weird stuff. So the immediate future is high frontier. When Reagan came in with high frontier, they called it Star Wars, and they sneered at him, and they made jokes. But he wasn't wrong. He took a bullet in public and lived. The Pope took a bullet in public and lived. You see that? How do they do that? That's odd. But the fact is, the Indians, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Islamic group, I'm going to call them just for now, and Brazil, and the North Americans, and the Europeans, and other peoples of the Pacific Rim, because I cannot believe that the Koreans will subsume themselves quickly and easily. Oh, they might, but they're very, very proud, very disciplined, very, and the Malaysians, the Indonesians, and the Filipinos are really just undetermined quantities at this point. But take a look at the Philippines; they've got the maturity, and the more we admit they've got the maturity, the more they demonstrate that they've got it, and that's what we've got to be doing. But we're going to be up there, 5, 6, 7 different interest groups in low and high orbit. Anything from 100 miles up to, you name it, the question of what's going to be on the moon, this, of course, will be negotiated between the great powers as they now stand. And we have to do something about that method of negotiation so as not to repeat the history that previously proved unsuccessful. So this is Gorbachev's open arms, which are so very readily and immediately recognized by the American public, because they know in their guts that if that's true, we can do it. You know, we can get together. Because whoever sits on the moon has got himself a firing platform for the planet Earth. You can carve out chunks of the moon and just throw them down like rocks. The thing is, it can go further, but I see it. See, I started out this off yesterday. I was thinking to myself, suppose it was not McLuhan and the electric environment at all that caused the late 60s to happen. Suppose it was just tiredness from two world wars and sheer terror of the atom bomb, which made the Beatles, with their expression of love, necessary. Russian teenagers wanted to listen to that music. They didn't give a damn about the eggheads that were making transistors at that time. See what I mean? They want blue jeans. They've wanted that for 20 years. Now they want TV and world travel. But which do they want first? What was most important? Is it really electric? Is it the electric impulse? Is it the telegraphies?
Or the content?
Or is it just the fear of the atom bomb? Just as simple as that. They suddenly, accidentally harness the power of the sun. Terror. 15, 20 years of terror, one generation, and then the whole brightness of the 60s followed, with all the irrationality, but the exuberance, the genuine, if you left Vietnam out of it, like there were so few wars happening, so much travel, so much peace.
Well, we have a holy office here, Cosmic Awareness, and its view is that when Rai returned to essence in February 1967, the original separateness in all mankind and humankind had disappeared. So maybe that's part of the cause.
Maybe.
Something happened. I mean,
well, I read another book about 3 years ago which says that in about 30 years we're all going to disappear because we're going to do it by high tech. Like, in other words, the form this book, you should read it. It's called Marooned in Real Time. It's by a fellow called Werner Vinge, V-E-R-N-O-R.
Okay.
V-I-N-G-E. Get it in any science fiction bookstore. But his premise is quite beautiful. I think he is a physicist or some kind of a university professor. His wife writes poetically oriented science fiction and is sort of environmentally tainted and a genuine, gracious writer in her own right, but his books are brilliant. What happened, the guy went to sleep for about 20, 30 years, and when he woke up, holy shit, everybody was gone. And it's really, it's a very interesting story from there, but you should kind of read it. Let me, do you want me to go into it a bit? Or?
No, we have to wrap this call up. I really appreciate what you had to say.
Read that book, man, Marooned in Real Time. It's got two big things in it.
Okay, let me just respond on 2 points. Is he started off with McLuhan's Global Village. Marshall's real breakthrough was the idea, the percept of the global theater. Maybe you're aware of that, not the global village.
Okay. And, no, well, I hear you.
Yeah, and the other thing is when you speak of the great heart of Russia, Edgar Cayce predicted before he died in 45, you know, almost 50 years ago, that the hope of the world would come out of Russia. So I can understand your feeling for Gorbachev.
For what he says. My feeling is for the fact that I believe him. That feeling of belief, it's a gut feeling. I think, my gosh, if it's true, I can relax.
Yeah.
I have that kind of an ego which will try to stand over the whole world, as I'm sure many of your listeners do.
Yeah, that's slack. Now, I know Gorbachev privately, and I assure you he was inspired by McLuhan. So it is a good question to ask, what caused those changes in the 60s? What changed the world? But it's interesting how certain patterns point to the hope of the world comes out of Russia, and the Russian is a McLuhanite. Isn't that interesting?
It is. Well, I see, I love it all, man. I love every piece of it. I love the English language. I love the roots of it. I love the cavemen that painted on the walls of caves 30,000 years ago. I love the idea that human beings have been around for about 500,000 years, brilliant and smart. But, you know what I mean? And that we're so dumb right here that we think we're the only human beings and, you know what I mean, that we did it all in the last 3,000 or 4,000 years.
Okay, that thought has gravity. We're going to leave at that.
Good.
Thanks. We'll be back on in 2 weeks. I hope you can input some more.
I'd like to hear. Yeah,
thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have another caller, Mike?
Hello, Bob.
Yeah.
Bob, I have a little point to put to our last caller.
Okay.
Vision is pink. Fusion is white. Right?
Yeah, vision is pink.
No, fusion. Fusion is white. Fission is pink.
Oh, fission. Right, you're right, right, right. Fission is pink. Fusion is white. You're, that's accurate. That's you can make a press conference with that statement. That's a formula.
Well, I really think we should be abandoning CANDU reactors.
Yeah, but I think this person had a lot of levels to cover, and I don't think he meant anything that he said to be held accountable for. You know, I mean, I think he's aware. You know what I mean? He had to say words. He had to talk about this and that to communicate non-verbally. And I think he would agree with you exactly.
This is true. He wasn't thinking in the 90s.
That's right. You sound familiar. Were you on last week?
No, maybe a couple of months back.
All right.
We were discussing the inner ramifications of the Woodstock media fiasco.
Is that your music in the background?
No. I guess that's an adjoining line.
Wow. Listen to it. It's a telegraph. It's a laser telegraph.
Well, we got another call, Bob. Do you want to go to the other callers?
So I think
I was just going to say, Bob, you're my favorite radionic practitioners.
Oh, yes, you're the one who wants some more stuff from Beater on ELF, right?
Yes, I was just going to...
We talked last week off the air.
I had a little word about ELF here.
Your stew.
The dark underbelly of our electromagnetic environment. Global ramifications of ELF. Since July 4th, 1976, the Soviet Union has been bombarding many parts of the world with ELF transmitters. The U.S. has since joined the game. Now a total of 14 transmitters are known to exist worldwide. It should be pointed out that in 9 years of transmissions by their government or ours, not once has a 7 to 9 hertz signal been recorded, a frequency that is beneficial for human biological systems. As you know, the solar government, the solar radiations coming from our sun are at 8 hertz. In addition, it is known that video display terminals, television, power lines, etc., all generate ELF signals that are destructive to biological systems. The potential dangers from this ELF pollution to the genetic future of humankind is clear. Mutation.
Yeah, it in some way what you say is the other side of the coin of our previous caller.
Yeah, I'm real glad that we're getting a chance to use the radio as a radio aesthetic device for healing instead of just destroying like the Pinks.
Yeah, that's accurate. That's dogma. I could live by that for a couple of weeks.
Right on. Okay.
Thanks.
Bob got another caller.
I have some bells to bring in the 90s with.
Just bring them on the way out.
Bring these bells on. Give them a few seconds.
Have a slack decade.
Thank you.
Okay.
No
we
bells.
Go to another caller.
Take the bells? Yeah.
I'm going to fade that out. It's okay. Yeah. Another caller on hold.
That person can call back and give us more bells anytime.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
All right, Bob. So I just, yeah. You know, before we go to the next call, I just want to make the comment that you had received criticism about not getting enough calls in, and we've had calls lined up all night. So you know, we really have to. I'm not like Barbara Frum. I can't just cut people off. I'm so enraptured in the conversations and the discussions, especially if they're good. And tonight's one of those nights. So if we can,
we're good tonight.
Ask our callers just to keep their questions or comments to one comment or question per caller, and Bob will be as succinct as always. I know.
Yeah.
But if
they're good, they get extra time.
You're listening to the extended version of the Church of the Subgenius radio show. I think we just lost our caller. But we'll try. Are you there? Hello? Hi.
It's quite synesthetically satisfying to hear the voice of Bob amplified electrically in the discarnate state. But I notice after listening for a while that the voice of Bob begins to obsolesce itself. But by the middle of the show, Bob usually gets his head together, retrieving lost slack while giving out the hidden ground of the Secret Council of Ten. Bob, don't let the congregation push you to your extreme, or you'll flip into your opposite and become the ultimate Pink.
That's true. We could use that as dogma, too. But I've always claimed that I'm a big Pink myself. You know, I don't exclude myself from the tensions of perfection.
Well, boy, it's been a dense night, hasn't it? A lot of the overall, a lot of people have taken offense to your comment about creativity.
Yeah, they
which
should.
Is one of the few occasions. Actually, I agree with you. I think.
Mike, I'm glad you said that because I heard you about three shows ago talking about the term new music.
Mm-hmm.
One week I wasn't on, and you said you don't like that term. You said nothing's new. So that's what resonates with what I'm saying. That's where
I think one manifestation of the 80s, certainly of the late 80s especially, is its refusal to accept its own time. That we're constantly, and I think especially young people, are in this unreal and unhealthy obsessive state with the past and with nostalgia, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and especially lately, even Philly Today commented on the 70s. Making this incredible revival, they pop up every day, and today's teenager is sort of an insecure mixture of of all these eras, especially the 60s and the 70s. Just as an example, anyway, it's sort of like an ad man's dream.
Right, but how does that relate to creativity?
I think that as a result, nothing is really original. There is no teenager who has come out with an identity. I mean, no new identity. They're just sort of mishmashes of the past that have just conglomerated into this.
It's almost like take a teenager, take its astrological sign, see which decade it matches with, right? You know, it's like you can program it. We can predict what certain generations will, what eras of electric replay they'll identify with.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's something, I had a note here. I wanted to talk about that for a long time.
But I think just also to follow through with that, the one long caller who, he commented on the, we live in this state of constant fear. And I think that's true also, that we become enslaved by fear, not only fear of the bomb, but fear of AIDS, fear of cancer, fear of isolation, failure, and poverty, to name but a few. And I think it's true.
Oh, downer.
Sorry.
Well, isn't fear the most raw emotion to give you a sense of being alive? And if we are a planet of the dead, then fear would be the desirable emotion you would... the only one you could get
would be the resurrection.
Yeah,
but I think the state of fear also squelches creativity.
Oh, I disagree. I think fear, because of its primacy, would encourage creativity, because it had any form of creativity. As the first caller was talking about, he was talking about going into oneself and finding that raw essence from which creativity springs. But I think I disagree with that, in the sense that any form of creativity is going to be coming through social structures. So when he talks about painting and talks about sculpture and talks about music, they are predetermined things, and I think fear brings you down to a level of primacy that allows true creativity, because it doesn't put you within the strictures of creativity must be painting, creativity must be one thing or another. And fear can make you extremely creative, because it's so primal.
But if fear is something that we aren't really feeling now, it's a reflex past emotion that we hoik up as something that seems to refer to the human identity. So human creativity has been motivated by fear, like you say. It's just that since creativity's been, we've been wiped out and we're no longer human, then the most primitive original feeling was fear. So we use that as a beginning point, as an anti-environment to our dead state, to create the genuine fake.
I'd like to go to another caller, if I could. You're listening to the Church of the Subgenius, extended final year-end radio blowout. No interest, no down payment until May 1990. And I'm Michael Dyer with Philly and with Bob, and we have another caller on the line.
And try your call again.
Uh-huh, hello.
Please hang up.
Yes, thank you.
This
your question
is...
Yes? Good. Okay, thank you, and... we've heard that voice before.
That was
before.
The electric environment, I think.
Yeah, that was the original fear icon. Mike, it's very interesting. They say today in criticism that most art forms have to reference their origins. In other words, it becomes not solipsistic, but what you're talking about, how the kids express with references to previous decades.
Should we just try this again?
Okay.
Sorry. Hi, Steve Kellen.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Hi, what's happening?
Everything.
Hello.
Everything's happening.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? I can't hear you, but I guess I can hear you on the radio.
Is this Cliff?
I was trying to do an overcover thing. What's happening, Bob?
Well, listen, Cliff, hey, I have something to ask you directly. I was listening to your show last Saturday, and did you hear that caller call up? And he's talking about Panama, and he had a feeling there's something bad going on from Washington. And then he goes, as Bob says, if it feels like that, then it is. Did you notice that? That guy quoted Bob.
It slipped me by, I must say.
Well, you were silent. I noticed you guys just ignored it, but I had to sit back and say, my God, my work has penetrated into Saturday morning life. I couldn't believe it.
It's a miracle.
Hey, Philly, what's happening?
Hello, Clifton. Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, I didn't even know you were on at this time, and I was just here beginning to flake out, and I said, well, let me turn the radio on to the number one station and see what's happening.
You haven't heard our show before?
Not at this time.
Okay, what do you want to put in?
Well, it concerns the idea of technology, especially since we're moving into the 21st century. You know, there is the concept where time and progress is measured in terms of technological development. And I don't know, it concerns, I guess, the whole question of instrumentation, the instruments that we use as technology. For instance, the Dogon in East Africa, the star Sirius is basically their cosmology. It took Western science until the 1950s to discover the star Sirius, when you can only see it once every 60 years with the naked eye. So the Dogon didn't actually have instrumentation. I only caught the first call you were talking about, the long call. That's when I actually phased in the program. But so I wasn't able to catch the essence of what he was saying and what your responses were. But just the idea of technology and how is it possible, or do the instrumentation, say, particularly of Western technology, actually become a hindrance to progress?
Okay, do you consider language technology, you know, spoken word?
Yeah, of course, certainly. In fact, the primary basis of technology, tell you the truth, communication.
Right. Now, did you know that the Dogon grouping, their term for language was a word that meant weaving?
Weaving?
Weaving, W-E-A-V-I-N-G.
Uh-huh.
That's what was pointed out in the 70s by some people I know, that the Dogon meaning for language was weaving. So they understood that language was technology, and or was clothing, and clothing is technology. So we're talking about our man-made clothes when we're talking technology. The Boer War, fashion.
What happens when you take... what I'm concerned about, though, I mean, I can take that, of course, because language, I mean, you're hearing me over the telephone now. It's
And telephone's a language. There's two languages going on here.
And other people are hearing us over through...
radio.
Through radio. Okay, now, of course, if I had a powerful enough voice to shout all that I have to say from where you are to where everybody is that's listening over the airwaves...
We're all in the same spot right now. We're all discarnate. We call that discarnate. We're all sitting in that center of this electrical system. In other words, you don't need to shout. Everybody can hear you.
Okay, but here's the other question then. Is that possible then without these instruments, without the instruments, if I'm not using the telephone, if you're not in the radio, can we still achieve that state consciously?
Yes.
Okay, and then what are the hindrances then? Is the instruments of technology as we have to use them become a hindrance to developing some of the implicit communicative aspects or the communicative aspects of our own technology?
Now, the original ESP we all had was the clothing we wore at that time. We've changed our clothes. So that's what humans do. They like to change.
Okay,
and so this creates new hindrances, but also new services.
But because of the lopsided nature of development in the world today, for instance, with so much of the West, of the technology concentrated in, say, Western countries, and where you still have, where they're still discovering people who haven't had as much contact with so-called Western civilization, right? So that there is a lopsided idea of communication, or I guess you could say that it's on some kind of a graph system, where there are different types of...
conceptual communication.
Okay, and is there some kind of gradation then to those kinds of systems? Can we say one is better than the other, or one is an improvement on the other?
We can do that as a pastime game, but it's not the real action. The real action is that the whole world is discarnate now, the whole planet. And I think that's what the long caller was getting at, is that we have imploded to such a point that Gorbachev and everybody has to say, hey, we're friends, we're all dancing on the same acoustic pin. So all cultures have to deal with that new present environment we live in. Now, to fill in the time, though, they'll hoik up their culture or someone else's cultural archetypes to sort of use the old medieval term of slanging, a form of debate and argument over contentual cultural past reference points. That's why the teenagers refer to the 70s and 60s, 50s as reference point to wake up their identity. So we got to put on the past as a replay to deal as an anti-environment to the present pressing environment of discarnate implosion. So, and that has no culture can claim that, because it causes an identity crisis in all cultures, West, East, Third, Fourth, First World, pre-literate, post-literate. We all are inside that environment. That's why no culture can be hoiked up as a final archetype.
Okay, what about the... this is very interesting because, I mean, my mind is jumping to what you're saying, too. This is a very heavy program, really. And it's nice to see that the airwaves are being used for more than just spinning some albums.
Great.
What about... What is the whole question of illiteracy in these societies, especially? Not just the idea of someone not being able to read, but... particularly with the proliferation of technological instrumentation, the ability of most people to, the understanding of the instrumentation that we have to use on a daily basis. Because I really don't think that most people understand the technology or that the intention is for us to understand the technology. So that, again, technological instrumentation as an element of some kind of latter-day slavery system. Technological slavery, where the instrumentation itself is risen up to some kind of godlike level, and yet there isn't the understanding of it.
Yeah, and that's what we call on the show here media ecology. That's what the Eastern European countries, in their nostalgic replay of the French Revolution or whatever, are going to have to really deal with. And the speed of it is that already now they realize they've got some new problems once they've knocked off the old bureaucrats in all cultures and all. Technological hardware instrumentations have to deal with the software instrumentation, which can't be visualized. I tend to think when we say we can't understand what we are using today, we can't see, we can't visualize how the content of the instrument works, and we can't visualize the effects. But we are experiencing the effects, and it's mutating us anyways. So we know in the anarchist tradition to not get too bureaucratized about the development that's happening. We should celebrate this extreme chaos we're having.
You know what I think one of the first things we might see happening in the Eastern Bloc countries, because in that celebration, a lot of people, I mean, so many different camps will claim whatever that euphoria is taking place there. You know, the supply side economics will say, well, it's a thrust towards market economies. Some diehard orthodox Marxists would say, well, it's a movement towards real Marxism, real socialism, real communism. I think one of the things we might see happening over there is maybe a deluge of some of the technological instrumentation we know as admin and PR freaks. You think we'll see some kind of PR? Because I think watching the news, particularly if the Eastern Bloc countries had some of the kind of high level spin doctors that are resident in some of these countries here, I think they might have been able to actually delay what we're seeing happen now.
Well, that's what Gorbachev's doing. He's the ultimate spin doctor. He's an expert on the tetrad. He knows the American military is using McLuhan's tetrad, and he's using it himself. He's already flipped and pushed Perestroika and Glasnost to its opposite. He abandoned Perestroika 2 weekends ago and instituted a new centralizing, as opposed to decentralizing, process of centralized control. 5-year plan, right? So he knows the processes will flip back and forth. And when he goes to Lithuania this week to supposedly scold them, he actually will encourage them. In other words, he's blowing four sides of his situation at one time, and he knows how to do it. That's the genius, because he studied McLuhan.
You're right, because, I mean, you've got to give Gorbachev his props because of the way he's been able to deal with that whole situation. I guess, how will his problem manifest itself? Because, of course, as all of these so-called walls come down, and, of course, we over here, I'm still looking for some perestroika and glasnost in these countries. I'm certainly looking to see all the Berlin walls we got to face every day in as rich, so-called rich a society as Toronto.
Wait a minute, Cliff. How about this, Cliff? Is that the reason we aren't going to have them knocked down? They were knocked down 20 years ago. We are ahead of the game, and we are putting them up because we cannot take the implosion. And we will continue to... We will not have the walls knocked down. The only wall that could be knocked down is to become aware that this technological implosion is killing us in North America. We're the least prepared culture to deal with what's going on.
The Gorbachev thing, though, will he have to deal with the same situations as the other Eastern Bloc countries, or how
How
will his technique be able to keep him away from, because certainly one of the things that we've seen is that most of the leaders who have been leading these countries before this wave are no longer leading the countries.
That's right. And you know what, Gorbachev, this is my first prediction for the 90s.
Go ahead.
Within the next couple of years, you're going to see an incredible meeting between George Bush and President Gorbachev. He's going to be president of a republic. He is going to totally get rid of the communists. The stuff that the West is holding on to is that, well, Gorbachev's a communist in the end. He's rechanging, updating socialism. Not true. Gorbachev is not a communist. He's a Skopsy. He's a secret Christian. And he will make his country the most democratic republic known to man, which is going to cause an identity crisis over here. So you're going to see that point. We're going to live to see when he meets Bush, and they're going to have a long conference, when you're going to have two presidents of two republics dealing with this historical baggage, which so much of our culture revolves around. What are we going to use as content for our new culture? We're not. We're going to go ESP. We're going to merge and hallucinate and do what that long call was about, which will require incredible discipline.
True, because, you know, in back to that whole Panama issue, seems to me as if instead of the despair that some people have manifested in the last couple of days, especially after the invasion, that it seems to me as if the so-called American empire is in terrible shape.
Yeah.
In terms of historically speaking, it's only been just over 200-300 years, which isn't, in terms of historical time, is not an extreme long period of time. Them going into, the Japanese are kicking ass economically, internationally. In terms of Europe, the economic center of Europe is certainly shifting from Western Europe to Central and Eastern Europe. France and particularly that country of England, it's to their benefit to keep things like NATO and so on, and the conflict between NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and all these kind of mock dualisms that they push on the rest of the world's people. So what do you see of the great monolith, the great empire of America, in view of all we've been talking about, technology and shiftings and changes?
Well, to heal a patient, you encourage it, right? So the rest of the world is going to mirror the American environment back to itself. In other words, as America disappears, the rest of the world will become American.
America, you mean Manifest Destiny America?
No.
Patriotism,
I mean,
America?
No.
Baseball?
The Constitution, the cultural archetype of George Washington and republicanism.
We are black people and natives are less than a man?
Well, that's the point. They will take over on the hidden ground, because as the third world, fourth world takes over, they will mirror to the American collapse that we are you. But they won't be America. They will just reflect that, because America is the ailing patient. So you have to be very careful with it. So you give it all the support as it dies. You pay your last respects by mirroring its achievements, even though you don't believe in them and are not going to live up to it. The rest of the world is going to be very hypocritical towards America, but it'll be a celebratory. You know, we'll celebrate this hypocrisy. Gorbachev will become president, you know. But he ain't going to be an American. He's going to give freedom to the third and fourth world, so.
Okay, one last question is, I mean, of course we know that the idea of dates and so on are very arbitrary, but we are going into another decade and into, after that, into the 21st century. In terms of technology and the democratic aspects of technology, what kind of instrumentations that poor people or people who are not on a high scale of economics in this society, what kind of technological instrumentation should we be looking to equip ourselves with within a reasonable economic range to make us be able to cope with some of the dazzle, Bay Street, Madison Avenue that I think they're going to deluge us in the next little while with?
I think they should use any money they get and get the next plane to Russia. That is the center of the 21st century. That's the new center of the solar government. And we got to pay our respects and make our personal connection with that. It's not that Gorbachev is a wonderful person. It's just that they suffered incredible pain for 60 years, and they had to infiltrate the Bolshevik power structure and take it over. They did that archetypal, heroic, godlike move, and we've been just sitting over here farting, and so we're not prepared to handle the 21st century. So we're going to, if we stay in North America, we're going to be pained. We're going to be in trouble here. All cultures, you know, from WASPs to the Inuit. Any point is going to be trouble here in North America. So for your own personal and for your cultural survival, start talking to the center, the Secret Council of Ten coming out of Moscow. That's what I recommend.
Mm. Well, hey, let me make room for some of the other callers, okay. No doubt. Mike, Philly, yeah, Bob, keep it up, yeah.
Thanks. Happy New Year, Clifton.
Right on.
Thanks for contributing.
Okay.
You got any more callers?
Not at the moment, no. If you didn't have to rush.
Oh, okay.
On.
I have a question. Philly,
says
yeah, I'm just wondering. You're talking about the pain that we're feeling in the so-called first world, whatever you want to call it, the Western world. Do you think this is one of the reasons why we in North America and in Europe are so quick to embrace the cultures of the developing world and the third world? I mean, we're running out listening to the music and buying the art and wearing the clothes of the so-called third world. Is that because our culture is become depleted or redundant, or we know that it's on its way out? And what is your interpretation of that way?
The agony in North America identifies with the agony in the third world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, we are becoming fourth world and disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And